Okay, this is continuing with Grote Reber on 25th October 75.
And
so you had
Oahu,
a broad horizon.
Yeah, around, pretty much around the horizon. Mm-hmm. I remember Oahu was just on the horizon, slightly northwest. So it gave an opportunity for try this interferometry thing on a great scale. And I did get some results, but not very good results.
Why did you think the C interferometer was more promising than the Michelson interferometer that Ryle was developing?
And Mills? Possibility, in principle anyhow, of being a variable spaced interferometer. When the source is right on the horizon, the spacing is sensibly zero. And as the source rises, then the spacing between the real antenna and the image antenna under the sea rises to twice the height of the mountain, which in this case would be a maximum of 6 kilometers. So I had a possibility of an interferometer where the spacing changed from 0 to 6 kilometers in about a half an hour or thereabouts. And so we would get patterns that started off very slow and increased in speed and got to be very fast. And at some place, the pattern, if the source had finite size within its limits, the pattern would disappear. This would tell you something about the size of the source.
Right.
Similarly, if there were a pair of sources, you'd get pairs of patterns, and these would beat. And then you'd get a compound pattern.
Right.
And furthermore, since it rose into the sea at a different angle,
right,
than it set into the sea,
that's right,
you'd get ideas about the cross section of this source in two different directions.
Right. You could do all this with a single antenna.
Yeah, see?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it did work after fashion. That is, I could measure the strong sources, Cassiopeia and Cygnus, and I was able to demonstrate Cygnus was a double in one direction, but a single in the other direction. And there were a few other sources, and I measured Taurus and bumped into Jupiter, a few things like that. But for the effort involved and the difficulty of doing the observations, it wasn't warranted.
Right. You have this short article in Nature in 55, and you say that the details of these studies will be described elsewhere. But I don't think there ever was a detailed paper.
About what?
About the Hawaiian observations, was there?
Oh, yes. There was an elaborate paper that appeared in the Geophysical Journal.
Oh, that's right. I haven't gotten that one yet. In 58 or 59, something like that.
Something like that.
Right. I don't have a copy of that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get
it. It gives all the calculations about position and the curvature of the Earth and everything else.
Yeah, okay.
And it turned out to be a difficult place, kind of a thing to do, because I neglected this business of man-made interference, which is bad enough back in Illinois. But see, here you were up on this tremendously high mountain, 3 kilometers high, looking out unobstructedly all over, and consequently I was getting interference from great distance. That is, for instance, they had a pineapple cannery, and they had a place where they made the tins,
mm-hmm,
and they had spot welders.
Right.
This was maybe 15 miles away, and that stuff, when they ran, just roared in there, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I could even encounter radio interference from Oahu, that's Honolulu, about maybe 90 miles away.
Jeez.
Yeah. Well, it was a direct line.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so you're in a very exposed position, just exactly what you didn't want. What you need, of course, is a hollow place surrounded by hills.
Right, right.
So, in this point of view, it was a poor thing.
But you had to go there to get the long baseline.
That's right.
And to get high. So, which years then were you working up in Hawaii?
About 1951 to 1954, about 3 years out there.
Mm-hmm. And
I took 1 year to get it going. I must have made observations in 52, 53, and 54, something like that.
And this was all supported by Research Corporation?
Yeah.
Essentially. And then, what was your next move?
Well, then I cast about for something else to do. That is, see, I wasn't part of any institution or part of any organization where I had to report to anybody and be on any given premises at any given time.
Well, I gather that's not your style.
Yes. So, you might say I was footloose and fancy free, in
right,
the sense that I wasn't committed to making observations out there in Boulder, Colorado for the rest of my life. or something like that. And so if I decided in my own mind that it wasn't worth spending more time, money, and effort on this Haleakala experiment, I could scrap the thing. We hadn't spent an awful lot of time and money on it. I extracted out of it what I could, which wasn't very much. And I thought, well, why fuss around with this at all anymore? Why not try something entirely different? Mm-hmm. And I think I told you I'd already made investigations as to where the atmosphere had the lowest electron density.
Right. Could you just briefly repeat that, though, because we weren't taping then?
See, so I thought, all right, now is the time to give that thing a whirl. Because you see, here it was 54. Well, this was near solar activity minimum.
Right.
And this would be an auspicious time. I was a little late, actually. And I had made contact down there in Australia and found out this circumstance where there were poles and wires in the hut and power and telephone and water. So I quickly hashed up some electronic gear for around 2 megacycles and took it down there.
Right, but before you go further though, can we just get the story of the, when you went and plotted up the NDS data? Because I didn't get that on tape before. If you just briefly repeat that.
Oh.
Was that while you were in Hawaii that you went to Washington, D.C. and
No. Some of that may have been done when I was... I've sort of forgotten the details of that. It was NBS data, and I think I looked at a lot of that while I was still in Washington.
I see.
But NBS also had an ionosphere station on Maui, the same island I was on.
I see.
And I undoubtedly... Yes, I did. I spent a lot of time there looking over their stuff, because this wasn't a thing that was done in a few weeks. This was done in patches over a period of several years, you might say. See, while I sort of collected my ideas. And I think these graphs that I told you, these maps, were plotted while I was in Hawaii.
Right. And these were maps of the maximum usable frequency?
Maps of the minimum critical frequencies.
The critical frequency of the ionosphere.
Critical frequency, yeah. Ionosphere.
As a function of position on the Earth.
As a function of position on the Earth for different seasons of the year.
Right.
Summer, winter, and equinoxes. And there were contours that said inside a given contour, the critical frequency dropped to some level or less. Mm-hmm. Inside another contour, to another level or less.
Right.
And these contours turned out to be, in the northern hemisphere, rather long streaks that were arcs starting up Prince Rupert and British Columbia and running down through Winnipeg toward Duluth and then across Lake Superior in the direction of Toronto and then back north again up beyond Quebec and St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I didn't really hardly believe these. I thought that they were a peculiar set of contours induced by some peculiarity, the way the data was taken or the location of the observers or what have you.
Right.
It was not a real demonstration of what actually happened in the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact it was, because in the late 60s the Canadians put up the Alouette ionosondes and they plotted their contours, and lo and behold, they were the same.
Really?
Thing.
Amazing.
Or very close.
What causes this streak? I mean, is there any idea what causes it?
Well, no, not really. It seems to be a combination of effects which has something to do with the fact that the magnetic axis of the Earth is not coincident with the rotational axis of the Earth, and that these particular regions are shielded from the particles that fall in by this geometric combination.
I see. And so
because it doesn't appear again over in Siberia. It's strictly on the side where the magnetic axis is displaced as far as possible from the polar axis.
I see. Mm-hmm. And so you get less ionization in that.
That's right.
Part of it.
And a similar thing occurred in the southern hemisphere, although it's not enough stations and there's so much water out there that you can't delineate it in that detailed fashion.
But was it, so there is a similar streak in the southern?
Apparently, but nobody. Why? Yes, there probably is, but I've never seen it drawn by anybody.
Hmm.
The Alouette people haven't done or reduced their data in that fashion. Anyhow.
Well, you found another hole in Ionis in Tasmania.
That's right, in the southern hemisphere, and it seemed to be, on the basis of the rather more limited data available, to be a deeper hole. That is, that the electron density dropped to lower, meaning the critical frequencies got lower. And so I decided to go down there, partly on the basis of adventure, partly on the basis that the southern sky looked more interesting with the center of the Milky Way and the Magellanic Clouds and one thing or another overhead. Partly due to the practical proposition that I was offered the facilities of these poles and wire and huts and things.
Right.
So I went down there.
Was this hole known about before you plotted this stuff up in Tasmania?
Well, no. I got a lot of advice from the pundits that I was wasting my time. That I forget all the reasons why not, why it wasn't any good. But in essence, I think one of the reasons proposed that it wouldn't work was it'd be a lot of absorption in the ionosphere. And another reason proposed was that I'd get a lot of radio interference from man-made stations. And even if I could find a clear channel, I'd probably get drowned out by atmospherics and I don't know what all the things. But when you start to question these people on the basis of their pessimism, they really didn't have anything. But there's a philosophical point here. That is, if these people thought it was any good, they'd be doing it.
Yeah. Sure.
So when you go out and you get this kind of reaction, it's to be expected. They're interested in the things they're interested in, whatever they are, see? And they think those things are good, therefore they're doing them.
Right.
So you come and you suggest something else, and they haven't given it any thought, and offhand it's very different from anything they have ever thought of, or and it can't be any good, because if it was any good, they'd know.
They'd already be doing it.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Well, in any case, what happened was that...
When did you go down to Tasmania, actually?
I got down there on the 1st of November, 1954, while I arrived in Sydney then.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get to Tasmania for some weeks later. That's summertime. And I got my equipment all organized and going by, I don't know, February or so, which is still summertime. But I don't remember we tried it out until along in March, which is autumn. And it was rather cumbersome. I had one of these high-speed recorders by brush. And the idea was that, I had listened to all the pundits, and so I had naturally gotten influenced by them. And the idea was that by having a high-speed recorder, the pen would come back quickly with a short integration time and thereby arrive at the background level in between the surges of atmospherics. And this is true when there's atmospherics around, but it's not true under observing conditions because there aren't any atmospherics. And we set the thing up and during the day and tuned it to some frequency of about 2200 kilocycles. They went away and let it run and came back in about 3 days and looked to see what I caught. And lo and behold, on the very first night, the ionospheric hole opened up and I got a beautiful trace without any atmospherics or interference or anything.
Amazing.
And the succeeding two nights weren't as good because the electron density didn't drop back as far. But then as winter came on, and I got a long series of traces. And what happens is that when the electron density really does drop below the the critical frequency, below the observing frequency, then there's sensibly no absorption. And since there's no absorption, there's no reflectivity in the ionosphere either. And so all the man-made stuff in atmospherics disappears out in space, doesn't come back.
Oh, I see, right.
You just got a void up there.
Right.
And all the stuff that would be bouncing back and dribbling in.
It has to come directly to you. That's the only way you can get there.
Yeah, and also it turns out that the cosmic static intensity at those frequencies is very high. And So it drowns out anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the observing conditions are good enough to get suitable data, then they're so good that you aren't bothered by any terrestrial stuff.
Right. Very interesting.
There's an in-between situation. That is, you can have a daytime situation where the ionosphere is absolutely opaque, and then the D region goes away, and you still have critical frequencies which are much too high, and then the critical frequency drops gradually, particularly in the evening. It doesn't do it uniformly and slowly. Apparently, the ionosphere breaks up into blobs gradually, and these things gradually dissipate. So there's a transition region of anywhere from a half an hour to several hours. And during this period, the cosmic static leaks through and the pen is going up and down gradually, mm-hmm. anywhere from a period of a minute or less to a period of several minutes or a half an hour. Well, these aren't useful data. But then once the hole really opens, it becomes transparent, and the hole is big enough to encompass the entire antenna beam, it draws absolutely straight, beautiful traces. Mm-hmm. The signal noise ratio is as good as any of those.
Mm-hmm.
There's not been any atmospheres.
Very interesting.
So, when the circumstances are good, they're very good.
Right.
And
when the signal comes, the noise goes away. Very interesting.
Right.
But I haven't asked you, what was your motivation to go to these very low frequencies? What,
well,
what made you think of them?
I never did know much about this microwave stuff. And furthermore, it seemed to be in good hands. That is, these fellows that are doing it seem to know what they're doing. They've got resources far beyond anything I have. And there's no sense to me trying to compete with them. That's silly. They're all knocking themselves out competing with each other. Why not use your wits if you've got any and do something different?
Mm-hmm.
And here was a situation which seemed to be worth exploring. I'd gotten all this pessimistic advice. Mainly because I didn't really know anything. These people who were giving me this pessimistic advice were merely telling me they don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And there wasn't anybody who knew.
And they hadn't even bothered to try to know either.
So, how could I lose? Again, I was in a situation back like in Illinois. That is, all I had to do was do something new and different and keep my eyes open and see what happens.
But I gather also that you had made the decision that that your style was to work alone and that you weren't going to join it. But by this time, there were groups that you could have joined, undoubtedly.
Oh, I could have, sure.
Right. But that you just like to work by yourself and...
Well, yeah, supposing I had joined a group, I had two choices. Either I worked with them on what they're doing and participating in to the extent that I could, or I engaged myself in a lot of arguments with them about trying to do something different.
Yeah.
There's no point in that.
Yeah. Why not just do it yourself, yeah?
If I'm going to do something different, I might as well do it on my own instead of engaging a lot of arguments.
Right. The only possible advantage would be that you could get more funding if you were part of an institution.
Perhaps. I never was really short of money. That is, I could have spent more, perhaps, but the mere spending a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean you're going to gain results.
No, that's certainly true. So, where does Ellis fit into
well,
this?
Well, he's the one that invited me down there, really. He was a graduate student at the University of Tasmania. And to support himself, he was running the ionosphere station for the Ionosphere Prediction Service of the Australian government.
I see.
And I don't remember how I got in contact with him. It may have been through some paper he wrote in one of the journals. And I guess that was it, because he had been writing papers on the ionosphere. In fact, that's, I think, what some facet of that he used for his thesis with the university. Anyhow, it was through him I learned that they had moved their ionosphere from one place to another and that the old station was open. And so I went down there, and he thought it was a good thing, so he joined with me and we did these together. And he's been working at it more or less ever since.
Ellis has.
Yeah.
Right, and well, and you have too,
yeah.
In one form or another. What do you think, in your opinion, are the primary results that have come out of this low-frequency research?
Well, the intensity of this stuff continues to rise as low as the frequencies we're able to measure. And it begins to the absorption due to ionized hydrogen in the Milky Way begins to show even the 20 megacycles and change results.
Right.
Not greatly, but it's there. Ellis' results at frequencies down to around 5 megacycles show it more pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And at 2 megacycles, it is even much more pronounced. This is not surprising. However, at 20 megacycles, Shane's results show that there's still a long and complex bright continuum spread along the Milky Way, and that at higher galactic latitude it gets fainter and fainter.
Mm-hmm.
At the lower frequencies, this phenomenon is still present, but not so pronounced. When you get down to 2 megacycles, the situation becomes more extreme. And it turns out that the 2 megacycles, the background is not bright along the Milky Way. The background is brightest at high galactic latitude. And you have strung along the Milky Way a series of these absorption regions. So at 1 megacycle, the situation should become even more extreme. That is, the bright region should contract to some very bright small area around the galactic pole, and probably the absorption regions along the Milky Way will coalesce into a rather large band, getting even darker and wider.
Mm-hmm.
And if you integrate over the whole sky, you'd probably find that the total integrated intensity would drop because of the large amount of absorption. So, limiting the discussion to the 2 megacycles, which we have data on, it's very evident that there's some very bright region outside the Milky Way that's producing these celestial radio waves, and that they're being absorbed by the ionized hydrogen within the Milky Way.
When you say outside, might that include a halo of the Milky Way, or do you mean truly extragalactic?
It's certainly large compared to the Milky Way. It is not twice as large, maybe 20 times as large.
Hmm.
It may be connected with the Milky Way, perhaps. Although the absorption is so complex and so great that you cannot identify this bright region as having a structure associated with the Milky Way.
Hmm.
And
How is it that you get a handle on this size?
I think I've got.
Well, is this paper here that you're. The 69, 68 paper?
The 68 paper.
This is the one that you're.
Yeah. Well. See, this is the brightest region in here, but there's one little bright streak around here. But it's not up much. These are in dBs. I can't read that. I think that's 22, 21, 20,
right.
22. And this is Centaurus here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the deepest, darkest patch right on 0 degrees longitude and latitude.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's these two more or less equal dark patches at each side. I think this is the thing associated with the Gum Nebula, or it's that one, I can't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
There's another little patch up in here. But in any case, if there's any structure to this bright region, it's very large compared to the Milky Way.
Because the bright regions extend to all latitudes, is that?
Seemingly so.
Is that the reason?
That is, if the bright structure were...
If it were just local, then you wouldn't see the absorption here.
No.
And so it has to be somewhat larger than the Milky Way.
But it's got to be a lot larger than the Milky Way. Well, this works on either side of it. For instance, if this is the visible Milky Way, and we're out here somewhere.
Right, you were saying Jansky's antenna reconstruction.
Yeah, I was there at Green Bank rehabilitating my antenna in 1960. And this was to be on the left-hand side of the front entrance to NRAO Observatory.
Right.
And so I thought it would be nice if a reproduction of Jansky's antenna were erected on the right-hand side of the front entrance. It would be only suitable or appropriate. And so nobody there seemed to be interested. But I wrote to Southworth, who had retired from Bell Labs, and suggested the project to him. And that if he thought it was a suitable kind of project, he would know the proper people at Bell Labs to take the matter up with, which he did. And he got a positive response saying that he had contacted the laboratories and they had decided that this would be a fine thing. And furthermore, they had investigated the matter and they were able to locate all the drawings that the original antenna was made off. And furthermore, by good fortune, the man was still on their staff who had built Jansky's original antenna, but he was going to retire pretty soon. And that they had made a pretty thorough search, and the only thing they could find left from Jansky's original antenna was a speed reducer. And that they were willing to undertake the reconstruction of this according to the original drawings, just the way Jansky had it. But they were handicapped by the fact that they didn't have any more hardware than a speed reducer, and it was imperative to find some wheels and axles from Model T Ford cars. And so there wasn't any available at this late date in any automotive junkyard. Did I have any suggestions? Yes, I did have a suggestion. That I was out there in the boondocks of West Virginia, and that I would put an ad in the local Marlton paper, which I did a number of times, to find out if there was anybody in the farming community around there that had any old Model T Ford cars laying around. And I was able to locate a suitable number of Ford Model T front axles and wheels, which required a minimum amount of repair, which I did get. And we also, by good fortune, found that we could get the tires and tubes. I think these are 21-inch wheels with 440 tires. These tires and wheels were being manufactured today and sold through Sears Roebuck because they were a popular item with these antique car addicts.
Right.
So I collected the wheels and the axles, and they bought the tires and tubes and all the rest of the gear, and manufactured the whole thing, and it was brought down there and put together after I left.
I see.
So you
chipped into that, but it was this, it was actually the carpenter that worked on it that supervised the reconstruction.
Yeah. Very interesting. That's what I understand. The same carpenter built the thing. And he wanted to make changes in it to make it better, and they wouldn't let
him.
They wanted the way it was
made. As a historian, I'm glad for that. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, I'm getting sort of worn out.
That ends the interview with Groten Reber on 25th October 1975.